don't need no education.
Welcome to Education Nation, where we tackle the biggest issues in American education. Your host is the headmaster of Liberty Classical Academy, Rebecca Hegstrom, along with co-host Mark Durkin. School is now in session.
Well, good morning, and thank you for joining us here on Education Nation. I'm your host, Rebecca Hegstrom, and I am joined in studio once again with Mark Durkin, our executive producer of Education Nation, and my co-host.
It's early Saturday morning.
Yes,
good morning to you, Rebecca.
It is, and it's in January, you know.
Cold.
We kind of have to get through these next couple of months until we see the bright warmth of spring, right?
That's right.
Yeah. Well, we had a great show last week where we had Dr. Brian Kress, a local pediatrician from Stillwater Medical Group on, and we were talking about concussions and learning about what they are exactly and why they affect children's schoolwork especially. Mm-hmm. It was very interesting for him to describe what a concussion really is.
Physiological structures, absolutely.
Yes, the changes that are happening in the brain that actually cause the problem to begin with, and maybe if we have time, we'll even ask him to maybe describe that one more time again in studio today, because we are very happy to have Dr. Kress in studio with us again today.
Thank you.
So Dr. Kress, like I said, is a pediatrician with the Stillwater Medical Group, and he's been practicing medicine for over 24 years, and he has had extensive training and experience working with concussions, mm-hmm. including my own son, as I brought up last week as well. And very grateful for your treatment of him a number of years ago. So, but this week we're going to turn the tables, right, Mark? Why don't
That's
you
right.
share with us what we're going to be
well,
doing
last
this week?
Last week we talked about diagnosis and some of the symptoms, not only physically, but also cognitively and emotionally. But we want to turn our attention to the process of recovery. This is really what parents want to hear once they get over that initial scare. Okay, this is what my child's dealing with. How do we nurse our own children back to healing and recovery? And so what should parents do if their child sustains a concussion?
Yeah, so initially, it's removing the child from competition or removing them from the risk of injury, and then either immediately or in the short term afterwards, restriction of physical activity and some cognitive rest. The whole post concussion management is there's a lot of style points that people have, and so there's It varies from provider to provider, and honestly, based on how significant the injury was and how many concussions a patient has had in the past. So initially, it's some physical rest, somewhere between 24 to 48 hours, with some gradual and progressive return to some physical activity designed to avoid exacerbation or worsening of the symptoms that they may be having after the concussion. From the cognitive standpoint, really complete avoidance is important. Possible of any stimulation. Initially, well, a few years ago, there was some thought of essentially putting kids in a dark, padded room. Mm-hmm. You know, no screens,
yep.
No screens, no noises, no lights, no nothing. Well, that's really never ever been practical. And I think as we move forward, we realize that some screen time, some pleasure reading, some social visits are okay. But really trying to manage those and keeping them down in a manageable way.
Mm-hmm.
Kids can attend school after these first day or two. Depending on how they're feeling.
Sure.
One of the challenges is to help them manage that between the parents, the teachers, and the school nurses, and as well as us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, usually a letter from a physician kind of outlining some of the concerns with respect to the concussion is very helpful. I can say that from an administrative standpoint, that because on the outside, the child looks normal. So teachers and students might not realize that there really is something going on here. And that's where it is so important to get a letter from the provider kind of outlining what they can and cannot do and what to watch for and how to intervene in those cases where maybe the headaches come back again, what can be done there. So having that letter from the provider, I found to be very helpful.
Well, I think you're exactly right. You know, because there's no marks on the outside necessarily. Right. We're fighting against a long history of just buck up and get through it.
Yes.
And
right.
So yep. There's still a lot of disbelief or difficulty believing mm-hmm. a patient's symptoms.
Yes.
We find that to be very important, though, for recovery.
Do you think, is it ever normal for a child to take months to recover from a concussion? Or would you begin to think it's not a concussion anymore, it's something else, or that it was worse and more severe than you thought? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, absolutely. Now, most concussions, somewhere in the 90 or so percent of mm-hmm. concussions resolve within 2 weeks or so, with good early rest and return to play, but there's some that do linger and do linger a long time, and that's if they are lingering longer, that does give us more concern to maybe look at some other diagnostic things like MRIs or some neuropsychological evaluations in the future if people aren't responding like we would expect them to.
Right. That's a good point. And then one other point before we move on to the next question, Mark, I wanted to point out that in some cases, I know with concussions, it's common for physicians to request that a child or adult who suffered the concussion to be awakened every several hours throughout the night. Now, is this still in practice, or is this an old practice? I know they were probably looking for bleeds, right?
Right.
Concussion actually being more severe than they initially thought, and so they're expecting potential worsening of symptoms, so they want them to be awakened to make sure that they're alert. Is that still something that's practiced today?
Again, that's kind of an old habit that's been difficult mm-hmm. to get rid of, but it's we do tend to want to evaluate somebody based on their symptoms, and once we clear them in the sidelines or the emergency room or clinic, then I think they should be able to go to sleep when they want to. But mm-hmm. that's a difficult thing to get people to believe
to stop doing.
Yeah. Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You know, last week we talked about some of the physical symptoms that start to appear when a concussion has been suffered. But just as a refresher, Dr. Kress, if you could just share again some of those specific symptoms that should tip parents to make it a top priority to get their child in to see a doctor right away.
Sure. Yeah, so things like prolonged loss of consciousness, altered mental status after the injury. If somebody's having seizures, those are reasons to bring them in right away. If somebody really has a difficulty with their balance, they can't stay upright, would be a good idea. A rule of thumb in most ERs around here is if once somebody throws up three times.
Yes.
And then they buy a CT scan or an MRI. They get a more formal evaluation. Mm-hmm. And certainly, if there's other injuries, visible injuries, then you have to raise your bar of suspicion to have your child evaluated.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I know. Again, I keep going back to my own personal experience. I know we've had other concussions, but the one that was most severe was with the one that had it 2 days in a row, mm-hmm. two different concussions in a row. And I know on the second day, I wasn't actually home when it happened, and he just laid on the couch all day and just became increasingly tired and more tired and more tired and more tired. And then when I called to check in, and my oldest son, who was a college age student, said, well, he's just been laying around sleeping all day. And he said, and oh, by the way, he fell in the kitchen and hit his head on the counter again. I went, what? And that was a scary thing to hear. And by the time then I found out that he had been tired and we needed to get him into the emergency room, then he threw up. Mm-hmm. When they got him up to go to the emergency room. So, you know, by your standards today, where it has to be three times, would they not have done an MRI on him?
Well, I think, the vomiting by itself. Once you get to three episodes of vomiting, then that kind of buys you a CT scan or an evaluation. Yeah. But I tell people, whether it's about a concussion or a breathing issue or whatever, I mean, it's if you have a gut feeling that something isn't right, then you need to get a hold of us or bring him in. And it's, I mean, I've been... amazed at the not just maternal instincts, but parental instincts, I call it. And, you know, you just have to respect those things.
Yes.
And it's you can't put a label on it. It's, mm-hmm. it's pretty amazing.
Yeah, that is interesting. The power of love.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So how important is mental rest to the child's recovery, and how can parents help their concussed child achieve mental rest?
Well, yeah, certainly this is a situation where kind of an ounce of prevention is probably worth a pound of cure.
Mm-hmm.
You do want to be somewhat proactive at getting your child some amount or significant cognitive rest. The more you stress the brain right off the bat, then it probably causes a prolongation of recovery.
Mm-hmm.
This is certainly a controversial thing. You really can't control for it from injury to injury and study to study, but it certainly looks like the longer recovery times are probably due to, or can be at least partially attributed to, decreased a shortened course of cognitive rest.
Okay, so lack of compliance with the recommendations.
Yeah, wow, yeah. So that's always a problem.
Right.
But you do have to be careful not to decompensate. Again, putting your child in a soundproof booth for a week, you know, mm-hmm. that kind of decompensates them as well. And so you can't really. It's a work in progress every time.
In other words, that's going overboard.
Maybe going overboard. But
yeah,
And I was at a meeting. It was a year ago. The speaker had just gotten back from the international meetings, mm-hmm. in Berlin or something they were, and they're talking about more. The latest movement is to actually work your brain a little bit, not again,
really?
within reason, yeah. But you give a little rest to begin with, and then you start the process. He made the analogy that, you know, we after people get a new heart or a new hip or whatever, we get them out of bed and we work it.
That's true.
And working, but the brain, we make the most active, healthy people on the planet do nothing.
That's true.
And now your brain can be different than your hip.
Sure.
I can admit that, but
sure.
He had a really good point.
Huh.
So
it'll be interesting to watch that research and see what does really prove to be the most beneficial.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Huh.
What does mental rest look like? I mean, just for the fact that we're such a busy and we've got a lot of noise in our society, what does that look like?
So anything that kind of stimulates your brain, whether it's the lights in the room, and it can be the fluorescent lights that just kind of cause headaches, but the maybe incandescent lights don't. Mm-hmm. It's texting, it's computer reading, it's watching TV, it's video games, it's reading, pleasure reading, it's just letting your brain kind of relax.
Mm-hmm. Shut all of that off for a little bit.
As much as, within reason. Yeah, right. I think nobody can flip the switch.
Right.
Maybe, I mean, personally, when I try to flip that switch off totally, I'd go crazy, and my brain works even harder. So,
would you argue that screen reading would be more, or I should say, less restful on a brain than reading from a book because of the screen element and the light?
I mean, my inclination is to say yes, but I don't know if that's really true or not.
Mm-hmm.
But it certainly seems
plausible.
Like plausible.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, academic responsibilities, we know that they involve hard work and it's a vigorous use of the brain. How is school affected by concussion? I know last week you mentioned about having to wear sunglasses in the classroom because of a lot of the bright lights, but what might be some other things that could be affected by a concussion in the school environment?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, everybody, I think, is generally accustomed to hearing the return to play protocol, but they've kind of coined another term as well, a return to learn.
Mm-hmm.
Which can include accommodations in the classroom to shorten a class time or shorten a class day, allowing a student to take several breaks throughout the day to go into go lay down in the nurse's office or a quiet room, decreasing their workload throughout mm-hmm. the day, giving them learning aids, meaning whether that's a tutor or supplying them with class notes, and then allowing kids to postpone some testing, maybe the more high stakes testing, maybe like an ACT score or a final or something like that, is very reasonable. So these go from academic adjustments like these to accommodations for prolonged symptoms, and that would be like an IEP or getting some neuropsychological testing to really see where a patient's or student's abilities are. And how they're changing, and even can end up with. I've had some kids with home-based schooling. They've been so dramatically affected by the concussion.
By the concussion, and yet it's still a concussion and not labeled brain damage.
At least initially, right? Yep.
Yes. Yeah. That is so interesting to me that you would end up with that lengthy of trouble.
Probably. By the time you get to neuropsychological testing and even the home-based schooling, but there's probably a point where, again, as we mentioned earlier, if you get to, we're talking weeks and months of symptoms, by the time you're getting to these kind of decisions, that it's probably time to see what's going on with an MRI or something.
And maybe you actually find some damage that is there as a result. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. That's very interesting. So it might have been more severe than they initially thought.
Right.
I suppose.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Okay.
You know, how can parents really know whether their child is using his or her brain too much? Are there any symptoms off of that might start to begin to show up, or is it just a prolong of what they already have?
Yeah, it's probably persistence of the symptoms or when they do go to school or when they're doing their homework, their headaches come back or they are having more difficulty sleeping. Mm-hmm. Certainly if the symptoms are worsening, that's a sign that they're using their brain too much. Okay. We talked about earlier the reporting bias, I guess, that some kids will have. They won't necessarily tell the parents what's going on fully. And so it can be difficult.
It's tough to be difficult to parent and to really help them come back.
So we've talked a little bit more about kind of getting back into the classroom. What about things like gym class and sports? You mentioned that there is kind of a back to play protocol. What is some of that protocol and how? What's the safest way to go about doing that?
Sure. So the general guidelines, and this, there's a lot of personal opinion, a lot of personal style when it comes to return to play. So it starts, so the return to play protocol really starts with rest. It's kind of a six-step approach towards return to play, and the number one step is rest. Okay. So when the symptoms have largely or fully resolved, generally, we start some activity, and that starts off with light aerobic activity. Mm-hmm. These are very vague, kind of broad terms, which I find we're developing some return to play protocols with specific sports-specific exercises and other ways to kind of monitor how light or hard the exercise is for the kids, which I think are going to be really, really helpful.
Yes.
So moves from rest to light aerobic to more sports-specific injury or exercises to non-contact training. Mm. So you can be on the ice and skating around, but no contact. Mm-hmm. The fifth step is full contact practice.
Okay.
And then once you pass that, then you move on to return to play, full play.
And how much time would you say generally is within each of these steps? Are we talking like a week or a few days? Is that
super
variable?
It is. Very variable. And depending on somebody's personal opinion or their experience, it can be a day. They can move up every day, depending if you do your light aerobic activity and you don't have headaches, you don't have dizziness, then you can move on to sports specific.
Sure.
Depending on the coach or the trainer, whoever's running these exercises, sometimes they'll say, I want to see it 2 days at this. Mm-hmm. I want to see it 3 days at this. Mm-hmm. But if you get to non-contact training, you know, the fourth step, and then you have symptoms, and you back off to the sports specific, and then you do that for another day or two or three or something, and then get back and then try to make that step again.
Sure.
But it's there's no rule.
Set rule.
Yeah.
So I'm sure a lot of professional judgment enters into that, too, then on the basis of not only the physician that's treating the patient, but also the coach that's then working with them, or the teacher, or the parent. I suppose it's kind of a group effort to decide what, how much time needs to happen in between each of these steps.
It very much is, and it's that's why I really employ the coaches, coaches for sure, but the school trainers or a physical therapy clinics in their community, to because they know the kids and they can be there with boots on the ground, so to speak. And I can't be there and do that.
Yeah, you can't go to all of your kid or all of your concussion patients' games and sports
every therapy session. Yeah. So.
I just find it interesting that, you know, because of all the variables that are in place and how each case is so different, the fact that everything is really open to debate or interpretation, and there isn't as much concrete fact or evidence in terms to say this is the protocol, it needs to be followed this way in every specific case, because every case is so different, it seems.
It really is. Mm-hmm. It really is. Yep. Hmm.
So, you know, we've been talking about all these different steps and what have you, and we've talked about repeat concussions and just some of the concerns about that and how long it might take for them to recover. Is there ever a time when you would decide to recommend that an athlete permanently step away from a sport due to concussions?
There is. I mean, there's all kinds of hot button topics in concussion, and this is certainly one of them. This, you know, sports really defines a lot of young people's lives and who they are. And so to make that decision to say you are done with sports is really emotion charged and laden. So there isn't in my readings and all the people I talk, there is not an absolute number of concussions that disqualifies somebody from injury.
Wow. So that makes it really difficult to know.
So it's a matter of maybe the family's tolerance of risk and how bad the concussions were, how long it took them to recover. If the concussions are happening with progressively less force, less and less of a hit to the head that's giving concussion, that's time to think about that. If you're having kind of more post-injury symptoms after the concussion, the cognitive dysfunction, kids are just really not recovering at all or fully from the concussions. Depending on the sport they're in, if they're in a high-risk sport, you want to take that into consideration. But again, it's a multi-layer. This is a huge decision.
Yes. How many times, in your 24 years, how many times have you recommended that a student-athlete permanently step away from athletics?
It's been a small handful.
Probably not
more than 10 or 15.
Wow. Some people. But even that many, though.
Yeah. But people have made their decision on their own.
Sure.
At times before, you know, in discussion with their coaches or the family just says, you're done. Mm-hmm. You're taking up basket weaving or something else. But it's but I've had also kids who were, again, were defined by their activities, and they had there was a head injury, and they got a scan and they found something abnormal in their brain that disqualified them from. And I've seen those kids kind of spiral. I mean, their psyches, they get depressed. You have to be very, very careful how you do that.
Right. I can imagine. It is. It's a big part of a child's social life growing up and their sense of identity.
And learning, team building skills. And there's just so many things that you learn in the context of sports that goes beyond the playing field. But I want to ask you this question. You know, again, much has been made of CTE. It almost seems like everyone's pointing the finger at the NFL and saying, see, they've got to shut this sport down in the next 10 to 15 years because it's just way too dangerous, where people's brains are completely destroyed because of all the hits. But based on what you're saying, again, it's really a case-by-case basis, and there really is no number or set number of brain concussions to say, yeah, once you reach this number of concussions, that person does need to walk away. So do you think maybe too much is being made, given how this still is all in the introductory stages of research, to really point to a concussion here, concussion there, to say that really football's in danger in the next 10 years?
Well, what I've read is, again, this is a daily changing thing for sure. So what I've read is that maybe some of the it's not the the big impacts that you see with the running back slamming into the linebacker or the wide receiver. It may be these multiple significant but not game changing blows, like the linemen bashing heads each other every single 70-80 times a game or something. That seems to be leading to more to the CTE as opposed to the running backs or the quarterbacks. But it's a changing process. I've also heard that there's certainly ways to tackle that are not as damaging to the brain, it's certainly they're already making some modifications to the game to the
hopefully, rules, right? Exactly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Is football by far the most dangerous of the impact sports when it comes to risk of concussion, or would you say that soccer is equally risky, or hockey, mm-hmm. or?
Yeah, probably the biggest impact ones are probably around here, hockey and football.
Okay. So you don't see as much of it with soccer?
I don't, no.
Okay.
No, and like you said, maybe it's just the antennas are up around the football field and not necessarily around the soccer field.
Right. Well, I had heard once that people think of soccer as not being very dangerous, and that it is one of the more dangerous sports because there's not as much equipment protection. And so that there's actually quite a few more injuries with soccer than you would ever imagine.
Well, I think that's true, yeah. Whether it's ankles or knees or cuts or mm-hmm. head injuries or, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Pretty interesting.
How about lacrosse? That's one sport we haven't touched on today. I know they wear the helmets in lacrosse, but have you ever seen concussion-based injuries through that sport?
Well, that ball is pretty hard, and yeah. those kids can is really it? Whip that.
I didn't know that. It's that a hard ball, huh?
Well, it's a bouncy ball, but it's firm. It's heavy, and it's not a wiffle ball for sure. But I've seen a lot of kids, and girls, I think now in Minnesota, I think are just now starting to wear helmets. They just wore mouth guards. That's it. I think that's true. Maybe this next year. So right, I mean they were they were just sitting ducks waiting to get hit by the ball. And again, maybe they're not generally as strong as the boys or throwing the ball, but it's still that can really pack a wallop when it hits them in the head.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm. And certainly there's a lot of bumping and grinding and whacking each other with the sticks that the other sports don't allow.
Right. Yeah, that one in hockey, I guess, have the stick component that can be pretty dangerous, I'm sure.
That's right.
But, it's hard because you don't want to take away from the benefit of sports. And, I've always said that I don't want to live my life. I don't want to run a school based only on safety.
Right.
Life has risks and pursuing dreams has risk. There's a lot of risks that we take in life. And so if we just try to put everybody in a bubble, we end up with an overly safety conscious culture, which in some respects we've kind of become that. And so how do you find that balance between recognizing that concussions are dangerous, but at the same time not overprotecting? Do you have advice for our parents on that?
Well, I think it comes down to awareness of the coaches of how to teach the kids how to play safe, how to check somebody, how to tackle somebody. You can certainly, like you said, if you become so risk averse, life isn't risk averse.
Right.
You can't, but you can manage
realistic.
It. You can manage it with better training and education, and then getting kids out of danger when they have had an injury, and hopefully getting them the appropriate care that to get them back to health more quickly.
Right. So really encouraging them to be honest about how they're feeling and the symptoms that they might be experiencing, and then getting the help they need before they jump back in.
Absolutely.
So good. Well, this has been an interesting couple of weeks having Dr. Brian Kress on our show with us and hearing about how to treat concussions and what concussion symptoms are and how to get kids back into the realm of learning and sports again. So I just want to say thank you for coming on both last week and this week, Education Nation. Dr. Kress, we're so happy to have you with us.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Very good. And Mark, always a pleasure to be with you again.
You as well.
And we look forward to joining our listeners next Saturday at 10:30 on KLBB Education Nation.